Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Reynolds Sports Desk. Your 950 KJR Sports Headlines.
Sports Headlines brought to you by our friends at VenueKings.com. Mariners win last night 6-2 over the Angels. They crawl back to 500 at 29-29. How about Jake Fraley hitting his first Major League home run? Justice Sheffield, 5 2/3, allowing just two runs. The two teams meet up again in Anaheim tonight. Could be trouble for the Mariner bats. It's Shohei Ohtani and his 2.72 ERA is on the mound, taking on a Robert Duggar, who just continues to shuttle back and forth and back and forth from Seattle to Tacoma. Cleveland has set its final shortlist to replace the Indians' name. The original pool was nearly 1,200 entries. Denver Nuggets on to round two after a win in Game 6 over the Blazers. Nathan Hale's Michael Porter Jr. had 22 in the first quarter on 6 of 7 from 3. They're going to face the Suns, who eliminated LeBron and the Lakers yesterday. Devin Booker, 22 in the first quarter, outscoring the Lakers by 8 himself. He would finish with 47. Stephen A. Smith reporting that the Knicks and other teams have already called the Blazers about a potential Damian Lillard deal. The Glove reaching a multi-year deal to be the new head coach at Lincoln University in Gary Payton's hometown of Oakland, who has just started its sports program next year. And the Washington Post is reporting that NFL locker rooms are likely to remain closed to the media for the foreseeable future, with in-person resuming in press conferences and small group settings only. I think maybe Michael Sean Dugar, our co-host for today, might have a take on that. And speaking of which, let's get this show on the road.
And now, two goofy, wacko, out-of-touch homers.
Just brutal radio. Just horrible.
Live. 41 yards.
From Elliott Bay.
Can you feel it now?
Hey, Seattle.
This is Softy and Dick.
Here we are on a Friday, 3:03. Softy and Dick without the soft one. Softy taking the three-day weekend, and why not getting a little golfing in? Nothing wrong with that. We are here, and joining me, like I mentioned to Ian, I mean, a star is born here in Seattle. The Therese Paler Emerging Writing Award winner, Michael Sean Dugar from The Athletic. First of all, congratulations and welcome. And second of all, what is the Therese Paler Emerging Writing Award anyway?
I'm a finalist. I guess I should clear that up. I'm a finalist with four other, I think, really good, dope writers, including one of my colleagues at The Athletic. But it's named after the late, great Therese Paler, who covered the NFL for a really long time. I forget his cause of death. He just died recently. But really, really good brother. I met him at the Scouting Combine in Indianapolis, I believe in 2019. And he was just really known for showing love to the younger writers. You know, I don't know how old Therese was, but like at the time I was probably like 26, still pretty wet behind the ears in terms of covering the NFL. You know, I was pretty young. And he just showed love right away. Just giving me questions about this, tips about this. You know, here's a link to this. Here's who you call. Here's how you deal with agents. Here's how you get front office sources. And I, you know, this is just like over dinner, he just happens to be sitting next to me. So it's like really fitting that this is the first year of the award. So this is the inaugural Therese Paler Award for Emerging Writers. I'm a finalist along with a homie Cam Wolf at the ESPN, covers the Dolphins. The homie Jordan Rodriguez, she covers the Rams for us at The Athletic. There's a Saints writer who I don't know very well and a Cowboys writer. Both women. Very, very excited to be a finalist for that, man. I'm super hyped. Thank you for starting the show, shouting that out.
That is really, really cool. But you writers and us in the media got some, not very good news today, I don't think, that I just mentioned in the update there with the Washington Post reporting that NFL locker rooms are likely to remain closed to the media for the foreseeable future, with in-person interviews resuming in press conferences and small group settings. So I guess my first question to you is why? I mean, if you're vaccinated, why can't you go meet with the players? What is the NFL saying?
Yeah, so my thing on that is the players have basically used COVID as a way to make excuses for why they don't want to do stuff.
Okay.
It's like, all right, COVID, we don't want to come to OTAs, you know, because we were able to go through OTAs last year, or skip OTAs last year, and, you know, still get the job done. And then they're kind of using it as an excuse for the media as well. It's like, hey, it's unsafe for me to be around you guys. And like on its face, it's like, sure, maybe it is, but we're vaccinated, like you said. Like all of us, I'm vaccinated, I'm good, I got the vaccination superpowers, we're all straight. But the other part of that is like, I'm generalizing a little bit here, so forgive me. But like, I follow these guys on social media. I know how a lot of these guys are kicking in the off season. Hanging around a bunch of vaccinated reporters at work is the least of their worries if they're talking about catching COVID. You know, right? No lie. I'm not gonna say which player or which city, but I had a homie text me, I think it was like last week. He was like, yo man, I'm in the same club as such and such. It was a Seahawks player. Packed club, right? Like if you can be there, right, for whatever reasons you're there, I'm not gonna judge, you can be at work talking to my vaccinated self asking you how you perform today. You know what I mean? It's like, don't just lie and use COVID as it. Like, if you just don't want to talk to us, then just say that. But I think they're using under the guise of COVID and safety, like, oh, we don't want to do these things. And I don't like how they're kind of trying to fool us like that.
Well, and OTAs are another thing. I mean, they're using COVID, the Seahawks using COVID not to show up for OTAs. And I'm wondering, and we discussed this a little bit earlier on in the week, whether, you know, this is something that Seahawks fans should be ticked off at, or if it's just, you know, Greg Bell and I, you know, we got into a discussion last week about it, and he was like, all right, you know, the Seahawks really aren't losing much not having this, you know, not having the team involved in OTAs when the Rams and the Cardinals and the 49ers are all doing it. And Softy's take was a little bit more of the, hey, you know, Russ should be showing some leadership. Russ should be out there. Russ should be doing this. So what's your take on that, that this team is the only team in the division that didn't participate in OTAs, and I believe, are they the only team in the league or one of the very, very few teams in the league that didn't participate in the OTAs?
Yeah, I have some of my colleagues, like, we're taking roll call across the league to see who showed up. I'm pretty sure I had to look. Everyone was like, hey, how many, just drop the number of people that showed up, and I was like 30, and everybody else is like 60, 80, full participation, so I think it's pretty low. I think the Browns are another team who hasn't had a lot of people there. But the thing about, so I get Softy's point about the leadership thing. I don't think it matters a ton just because, like, there's no one questioning Russ's leadership. Like, who has the cojones to do that? Mm-hmm. Right? I don't care who you are. No one's like, I don't know about number three. He's not really getting it done in the leadership department. So that's not really a thing to me. And I do get what Greg is saying, and to the extent of, oh, well, you're not losing a ton because you can't have pads on. There's only so much work you can do on the field with the coaches. Everything's limited. There's no contact. That's true. However, like Pete Carroll would say, it's relative. It's all relative. If all the teams in the league are there, and if all the teams in your division are there, you may not be losing much. But the question is actually, are you losing something? Mm-hmm. And if the
Especially
answer to that,
have a division like this that could balance on the blade of a knife.
Yeah, like think what's the separation between the Cardinals, Rams, and Niners, like in Seahawks. It's so, like you said, so small. So if you're losing something, even if it's just a couple extra days of install with Shane Waldron, that matters. You know, that matters. How much it matters is to be debated. But I don't think you can argue that they are losing something. It just matters how much, you know, like how important that becomes during the year. But no one can argue that the OTAs just doesn't matter when you're the only team, you know, having your whole club spread around the country.
And the other news that came down today, I was going to get into the Julio Jones conversation with you right off the bat, but we've got so many things coming down today, including this bizarre story. I think it was Pelissero that put it out there. There's actually four assistant coaches that are kind of putting their foot down and saying, we're not getting vaccinated, and therefore they can't be with their teams. I mean, they're going to be banned from the field, the meeting rooms, and direct interactions with players. How the hell can you coach football if you can't be on a field, in a meeting room, or have any direct interaction with your team? I mean, do they just have to fire these guys, basically, because they can't do their jobs?
There'd be a lawsuit coming. There'd be some guys in suits show up if you get fired. But, I mean, think about, I try not to judge people who don't want to get vaccinated too much, right? Like, you can do whatever you want. If you ain't near me, then I don't really care what you do, largely speaking. However, you've just got to be a dummy to not read the room in this regard as a coach, right? If you're one of those assistant coaches, cool. You realize last year you can get it done virtually. But if the other assistant coaches are coaching their guys in person, you are putting yourself behind the eight ball, like, voluntarily. Is it for a stupid reason? Yes, but I don't even think that matters whether you have a good one or not. If I'm with the Rams and the rest of the division that all have their coaches in person working with their DBs or their D linemen, and you're trying to do all this virtually, trying to have them, hey man, you know, use your handwork this way virtually through in their backyards. No, that you're putting yourself behind the eight ball. That's dumb. Like, that's just bad strategy, independent of what I think people who are against the vaccine. This is a strategic thing. You're putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage in a sport where the separation between teams is so small. Like, that when I read Palacero's report, I was like, man, those coaches must really not care about, like, their players. You know, that just showed that you don't really want to be in their best interest. I was almost tweeted like, wow, those guys must be great leaders of men. I thought people would take that as a slight about their vaccination like opinions. More, I thought of like, no, they're just being bad coaches, you know, which is their number one job at the end of the day.
I think the greatest line that I've heard about this particular topic was dropped on us a couple of weeks ago by Sounders coach Brian Schmetzer, and I tweeted it out. It got a lot of play on social media because I asked him flat out. I was like, well, how are you doing so well in this? I mean, you got the Mariners that are just struggling, you know, barely over at that time, you know, barely over 50% or whatever, and you got guys on the COVID protocol list, and the Sounders announced like 6 weeks ago that they were 100%. I mean, they had no issues from the get-go. Like, everybody just kind of lined up as soon as they could get it, and the whole damn team got it done. And so I asked him, I was like, how were you able to get this done when these other teams are having so many problems? And he said, simply, we've educated him, we've hammered home the importance, and his golden line was, I stand by your freedom, however, you got to think about someone other than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. It's like, okay, there's your right to do what you want to do, but then if it directly impacts a lot of other people and it impacts the quality of job that you do with these other people, like these assistant coaches, I mean, you really got to think long and hard about that.
Yeah, I mean, Cam Chancellor always tried to say, I mean, Richard Sherman too, that LOB wasn't just Legion of Boom, it was Love Our Brothers, right? And that's just the mantra has continued even though those guys are gone. And so you're always doing it for the guy next to you, whether it's wearing your mask or social distancing or staying in the house or getting the vaccine. Like, all of these things, you independent, again, of like the politics that have become wearing masks and the vaccine, just doing what helps the dude next to you at work should matter. Like, that would be my sell, like a Sounders coach. Like, if I'm Pete, like, the same thing. Here's the info. You're not going to die. Your face is not going to fall off. If you get the shot in your arm, you should be surprised, Dick, the like conspiracy theories I've heard about like vaccine. It's bad. Like, Facebook is a very dark place for for misinformation. But like, you tell them, hey, your arm's not going to fall off. You'll be fine. You're not going to die. You're not going to get COVID from the vaccine. Cool. You'll be all right. Now, get this so you guys can like bond as a DB room so we can have the best secondary in the league so we can win a championship. Like, that would be my sell. It wouldn't even be anything else. Like, make it totally about winning and doing it for the guy next to you. And everyone should be 100% by training camp on every team. Like, it should be that simple.
Michael Sean Dugard joining us on 950 KJR. We're going to drop the heavy stuff. We'll drop the COVID stuff and move on to something a little more fun, a little more lighthearted, because nobody loves speculation more than NFL fans. And this Julio Jones thing has been fun. I mean, this league never stops providing us with fun. 12 months out of the year, 365 days a year. You know, it's Aaron Rodgers one day, it's Russell Wilson one day, it's Julio Jones one day. It just kind of rolls from one story to the next, and we never have any time off, which is great for us because this is our living. This is what we talk about. And while I don't believe that Julio Jones is a good fit for Seattle, and I don't think he's coming to Seattle, it was interesting what Mike Florio told us on Wednesday when we had him on, because I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think this guy's got left in the tank, man? I mean, he's obviously declining in his career, and I thought he brought up an interesting comp. He said that Randy Moss in 2006 was in Oakland. He was banged up, he was disgruntled, and he caught 42 balls for 553 yards. and everybody started, and he said everybody was saying the same thing about Randy Moss that they were saying about Julio Jones right now. He's washed up. His best years are behind him. You know, he was 30 years old instead of 32 years old, so he was 2 years younger than Julio Jones is right now. But then Randy goes to New England and just absolutely tears it up. 98 catches, 1493, an all-time record, 23 touchdowns at the age of 30. So I got thinking. I was like, okay, now I don't think Julio Jones is going to go anywhere and put up those numbers this year, but is that logical? Can we see that maybe his disgruntled nature in Atlanta may have cost him some numbers, and if he goes to the right fit, he could put up big time, 1500 yards, double-digit touchdowns, which he's only done once, by the way, which is amazing, that have that type of impact to whoever he goes to?
I think there's a bunch of comps beyond, like, Randy Moss of guys in their mid-30s in the NFL who have performed well. I'm pretty sure Jerry Rice was good until, like, right now. I'm pretty sure, like, Jerry Rice could score.
Last year he could still play? Like, he said, I could still make a roster right now?
I've seen what the bottom of the barrel looks like in terms of rosters, like in training camp. Yeah, no, Jerry can probably make a team right now. So there's plenty of comps in that regard. But I do think that we need to make this point very clear. Everyone, Seahawks fans, Dick, I want you to hear this too. It's very clear.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Julio Jones is still good at football. He's never been bad at the thing. He only put up bad numbers last year because he was hurt. Like, if you look at, as we expand from 14 games to 16 games and 16 games to 17 regular season games, per game numbers are going to be a little bit more important than the raw numbers. And for receivers, there's a lot of per snap stuff, per target stuff that really shows how good you are. I think Julio was like third or fourth in yards per target, and like third or fourth in yards per route run.
Yep,
was still
yep.
top 15 in like yards per game. His drop rate was still like super low, which it always is. You go watch the film of him. I was there in Atlanta week one last year, but you go watch his tape, which I did earlier this week. Like, he's still good. Like, he's still, like, that's the difference between him and some of the other people that, like, you look at, like, Brandon Marshall or something like that, or some other older guys Pete's brought in. No, they stunk where they were at, and it was kind of like, oh, you're on your last leg. No, Julio was still very good when he was on the field. But I want to flip this back to you for a second. Even if you don't like the cost of the trade compensation, why do you think he's not a good fit in Seattle?
I just don't think – I think that Seattle needs to spend their resources elsewhere. Even, you know, if they hadn't gotten a third wide receiver with their first pick in the draft, I might feel a little bit differently. But I do understand that the third wide receiver is a big problem, has been a big problem in Seattle. I just think, man, do we want to invest in a 32 and then 33 and then probably 34-year-old wide receiver in Julio Jones, because that's going to take away from some of the flexibility that you can invest elsewhere? I mean, it may take away your ability to re-sign Jamal Adams. That's what gets me. Yeah, Julio with DK and Tyler were like lights out, ridiculous. I totally understand that. But is that going to be a detriment to the rest of your football team if you're putting all your eggs in that wide receiver basket?
Oh, okay. So it's a resources thing. Not, I thought you meant like a scheme fit or something.
That's
fair. I would say this, though. It does not impact their ability to extend anyone, because extending people will always free up space. Like Michael Dixon got extended today. I can confirm all those reports. That probably frees up like $1.5 million. It's not a ton, but it's an example of how when you extend people, you free up more cash. Extending Jamal can probably free up like 7. Extending Quandre can free up another 4. So I think that like the Julio part, I'm with you. Like the resource allocation is questionable. I hear you on that. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I would caution against the any idea that if you bring on a Julio Jones, it means you can't extend guys you have. It will prevent you from bringing other guys in, but it won't prevent you from locking up Quandre's and Michael Dixon's. And even if you wanted to, you know, lock up Will Disley, I guess, or Jamal Adams, anyone entering an expiring deal, it won't prevent that at all.
You know, it was interesting. I don't know if you saw it. You probably did. You scour Twitter like I do. Jason from overthecap.com wrote an interesting piece, I think it was Wednesday, and saying that he thought of all teams out there, at least analytically, of all teams out there, Julio Jones would improve Seattle more than any other team. I'll read just kind of an excerpt from it. He says, since it's a win now kind of move, we should also not just be looking at the 2021 cap, but also the 2022 cap, since basically a team can take the $15.3 million over 2 years, trade or cut Jones if they wanted to in 2022. Almost every team in the NFL moves into a dominant wide receiver core with Julio Jones. Seattle absolutely should be in on Jones this year. They do not have the cap room this year. They clearly have the two-year room needed to do this. They are a win-now team, and it would close any receiver questions that they have if you add a player like Jones. If it means not extending Jamal Adams, so be it, as they should be looking to win a title. So he basically talked about what Seattle has at the third wide receiver right now, which is, you know, say what you want about David Moore last year. I think he's very, very replaceable versus what Julio Jones could give you, even if it means potentially not signing Jamal Adams. I thought that was a bold claim, because obviously that seems to be the plan of Seattle, that Jamal Adams is a high, high, high priority.
Yeah, no, I read Jason. Jason's really good. Like, shout out to Jason Fitzgerald over the cap. He's super, like, he crunches the numbers and makes them digestible for someone like me who does not like a ton of numbers, even though I just cited a bunch of per game stuff. No, I mean, think about it, right? Tyler Lockett is a low end number one receiver in the NFL. Like, if every team has a number one, so that's 32 number ones, Tyler would fit. He's a top 32 receiver. Yes. You signed Julio Jones. Arguably, Tyler's now your number three receiver. That is insane. Like, yeah, I read that piece by Jason, and yes, I 100% agree. There's no team that increases their, outside of Kansas City, that increases their chances of winning a Super Bowl, I think, more by signing Julio Jones than Seattle. Again, I think at Kansas City, that'd be unfair. But I think Seattle really gets the boost to be like an NFC favorite by adding Julio.
Michael Sean Dugard joining us. Be here till 7 o'clock. And he was on with Softy replacing me a couple of weeks ago when I was on storm duty. And Jackson, you remember the day after I came on and I took a little issue with some of the things that Michael Sean Dugard had to say. And so now we have him here. And I'm not a man that's going to talk behind someone's back. I want to talk to him face to face. So we'll do that. We'll call him out a little bit in the next segment and see what he has to say for himself on 950 Kicks.
Now back to Softy and Dick on your home for the Huskies and the Kraken. Seattle Sports Radio 950, KJR.
Welcome back, Sports Radio 950, KJR, Softy and Dick. Without the soft one today, he is gracing the links again, playing a little golf on a three-day weekend for him. We'll get him back on Monday, but Michael Sean Dugard is joining us. And the last time you were in, and like you said on Twitter today, you must have done a good job because we had you back. You did a heck of a job. I really enjoyed it. I got to listen to about an hour of your show with Softy going into to do the Storm game that day. And you guys did a heck of a job, but there were a few things that I heard you talk about that I was like, okay, whenever the next time I get Michael Sean Dugard on the air, I want to ask him what he means about dot, dot, and dot. And the first thing was you used kind of a driving analogy to compare the Seahawks season last year, like the Seahawks offense last year. You remember when you did that, when you talk about, you know, you gave your girlfriend the keys to the car and let her drive for a second, and as soon as she like didn't use her blinker to change lanes, you're like, pull over, I'm gonna just take over the wheel. And I thought that was a little bit understating the mess that the Seahawks offense, the Let Russ Cook, had become. Because I really think after that Rams game and that Bills game, they just looked flat out broken with what they were trying to do. It was like the defense is adjusted to what the Seahawks had done the first 8 weeks of the season, and you needed a massive overhaul. And so I was kind of in agreement with Pete on the type of overhaul that he did. So I want to get your take again, because I want to make sure that you're, you know, I read you correctly, that did it really only take a little bit of tweaking to get that offense going in the second half of the season? They went way too far the other way?
Yeah, I think it was more of how it was a relationship thing. You know, like
hang on, Mike. You got a fire alarm going on there, man. You pulled the ripcord over.
Dick, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna bring Michael down right now, because there is a fire alarm going off right now. So we're gonna handle that back here, and I will definitely get back into that topic here coming up here in a little bit. I'm sorry about that. This is live radio, and here we go.
Yeah, live radio. Well, you know what you can do? You can put them in if you're not supposed to evacuate the building. And I mean, we've had fire alarms on the air before. You can bring him in the room with you, and he can use your microphone, because I can't hear it on your microphone.
That is correct. And I'm going to wave him down and bring him in right now.
How about that? Live radio, it's best. We got to, you know, people are finally starting to get back in the building, and somebody rips the fire alarm. So, I want to make sure everybody's safe there. I just think that, you know, when it comes to what the Seahawks did offensively last year, first half of the season versus second half of the season, I just felt like it was deserving of a massive overhaul, because not only did they start to play better teams like the Rams, like the Bills, those better teams figured out what Seattle was doing. And Michael Sean's back. So I just felt, Mike, that those teams, Rams, Bills in particular, A, were better than the defenses they were facing when Russ was cooking, and B, they had figured out via, you know, whether it's dropping to a cover two more and not having the single high safety as much. And they had figured out what Seattle was doing, and Seattle needed to make that massive adjustment. And maybe it sounds like, if I read you right, that maybe Seattle just needed to tweak it a little bit versus the massive overhaul.
I think the issue was a disagreement in philosophy. That was really the part that I want to drive home more than anything. It was that, like, I don't know if I can use, I got to think of other analogies than driving. I do like relationship analogies, though. I feel like those really drive home my points more than anything. I can't. The main thing is Pete has a way of playing Pete ball. That's his thing. You know, and Russ has a way of how he wants to win, because he's seen Pete ball win, but recently Pete ball has not. So even if they only shifted a little bit in, like, runs called on neutral downs, which they did, they shifted from, like, 65% pass heavy to, I want to say, like, 59%. Like, it wasn't a huge shift, like, statistically. Like, you didn't see a ton. And then you're right, the defenses did get better. But I think what the problem was, and people were telling me this after the Giants game, it was like, it's not that they just became, you know, the Tebow Broncos in the second half of the season. It's that, like, any adjustment was viewed, and throwing it less was viewed as an indictment of Russ's skills. That's probably the best way I can put it. Whether that's accurate or not, like, in terms of how Pete was wanted to, you know, express that sentiment, that's how it was viewed. It was like, hey, man, this whole throwing thing, you cooking and all that, nah, let's tone it down a little bit. And if I'm the one in that let Russ cook, if I'm the Russ in that statement, what you mean tone it down? Like, I'm the reason we hot. You know, I'm the reason we nice.
Was that one of the reasons that he didn't play well, is because he was frustrated? And he looked visibly frustrated at times in the second half of the season. Was it not just that he was frustrated over the quality of his play, but he was also frustrated because of this shift that took place?
I think so. I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, think of what the position that puts Brian Schottenheimer in. Right, let's say Russ is on one end of the spectrum, and then Pete's on one end, and you're shoddy, and you have to, like, Pete's the boss, but, like, you can't have a bad relationship with your quarterback. You just can't. Lester, you need to have a, like, very functioning relationship with this guy. And the Giants game was really telling to me. Like, you look at the Giants game in particular, talk about two high coverages. The Giants are really the only team who played those exclusively outside of the Rams in that second half of the season. Mm-hmm. And the obvious way to, you know, to attack that is run it, you know, attack the middle of the field, where Russ is traditionally not, like, as strong as he is outside the numbers comparatively. And they just didn't. It just didn't. It just, like, it was just stubbornness. And Russ admitted that, and Shoddy admitted that they just, the defense took away their strength, and they were like, no, this is our strength regardless. And that's stubbornness, and that's stupid. Mm-hmm. And that shows that, like, you can have all the talent and everything, but if everyone is not on the same page, like, Pete was probably thinking, run the damn ball. You know, you guys talk about the Huskies on this station, God forbid. But, like, Jimmy Legs, like, run the damn ball.
Like, right. If he's thinking that, but his OC, whoever the Huskies' OC is, I don't know. You don't have to say his name. It doesn't matter. But if he's like, no, we're going to throw this thing, then the offense is going to look like crap. Doesn't matter what the talent is. Like, that's, right. Well, that's why I think the relationship part of it is important. Whether the tweaks are huge or not, whether the numbers change or not, if the guys wearing headsets, including Russ, aren't all in agreement on how they should win a football game, mm-hmm. eventually they will lose football games, and that's what happened.
Well, I do think that, you know, you're right. Pete hasn't won at the highest level recently, but he's still winning 11 to 12 a game. And what do we got going, Jackson? Oh, he's giving me the – I got you. I was wanting to make sure you didn't need to, like, evacuate the building or something. But you – he still has won 11, 12 games a season. And I think the reason they haven't gone to the Super Bowl is not because of the style of offense the last few years. It's just flat out they haven't had as good enough roster to go to the Super Bowl the last 3 or 4 years. And that's been it. And let's talk about that after the break and see if you agree with that. Michael Sean Dugar coming up next with us on 950 KJR. We've got Fun with Audio at 4:05. Donald Watts is going to join us at 6 on a Softy and Dick without the soft one on 950 KJR.
Sure.
Now back to Softy and Dick on your home for the Huskies and the Kraken. Seattle Sports Radio 950 KJR.
All right, good news at 6:51, Elliot. Everybody's safe. Fire alarm's over. All good. Jackson's good. Michael Sean Dugar's good. We're all good. We're talking Seahawks football here on a Friday with the man that covers it, as well as anybody from The Athletic, Michael Sean Dugar. And we were talking a little bit about in the last segment about, you know, why the Seahawks haven't reached the pinnacle over the last 5-6 years like they were able to do 2 years in a row. And I think a lot of the criticism goes towards Pete Carroll and his, quote, inability to adapt. And yet, I would say, you know, the Seahawks have been very good through those years, and they've won, you know, 11, 12 games just about every single year. And I just don't see a roster from 2017 to 2020 that was a Super Bowl roster. It was a team that maybe had a puncher's chance at a Super Bowl, but it wasn't that you looked at them like you did in 13 and 14 and 15, where you just said, dude, find me a better team. Find me a better team than this squad on paper right here, Seahawks 2013, 14, 15. You just really couldn't, where that hasn't been the case. So does Pete get a little bit of a bad rap for, you know, because it seems like he gets the blame for not getting the most out of his football team because of the style of offense he runs?
Well, I mean, he controls personnel too. So if the roster's bad, that's him too.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, specifically as a coach. So here's my thing with Pete, and I've said this before, mostly on our Seahawks podcast. I do with Chris. Shout out to Chris Kidd that works here with you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Pete runs a style of offense that requires you to have an elite defense if you are going to win a championship. Like, if you want to run the ball and control the clock and all these other, like, cliches about ground and pound, sure, fine. Make sure your defense is elite, because you're going to win some ugly games. Like, you just are. That's what you're going to do. His defense has not been set up to do that. You talk about the roster, like, it's lacked on defense in particular. They've whiffed on a lot of defensive draft picks immediately that were tasked with immediately replacing members of, like, the Legion of Boom or someone, like, elite in that regard. Like, they drafted 4 defensive backs in 2017, hoping that some of them would replace Cam, Earl, Sherm. They got one of them right, and that was Shaquille Griffin. The rest of those guys are just, like, floating around the league trying to find jobs. And, like, Lano Hill is one of them, Mike Tyson, Tedrick Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And they've whiffed on some other picks in that regard, too. They want a Malik McDowell to basically be like the new Michael Bennett. They want a Rasheem Green to basically like the new Michael Bennett. Neither one of them is the new Michael Bennett, right? So I think the roster part of it falls on Pete as well. But I really think that if you, like, look at the Chiefs in 2018, they had a very bad defense and were, like, offsides from D Ford away from making the Super Bowl. Why? Because their offense was so damn good and so damn electric. It was designed to outscore you every Sunday. Whereas Pete's like, we want to outlast you every Sunday. Which, sure, it's one. Like, I get why Pete wants to do that. But if you're going to do that, you need to be able to outlast the other guys on defense as well. And if you're, you know, if your free safety is Tedrick Thompson, you're not going to outlast people on defense. You're just not. So I think that is why I'm critical of the offense,
because unless you're going to have an elite defense, you're better off being a pass-first team. You can be a run-first team with a mediocre defense. However, you can be a really good pass-first team with a mediocre defense and still get where you need to go.
When I heard with Softy a couple weeks ago, you were talking about the drafting of Dwayne Eskridge, and it almost seemed like you were a little critical of it because it didn't fit Pete's style of ground and pound, and yet I would almost say, well, doesn't that show that Pete is willing to adapt because he realizes that we need to get to the ball into the slot. We need to have three wide receivers since we're in three wide receiver sets so often. So how do we reconcile that, you know, do we criticize Pete for not adapting and then on the same hand criticize him for his pick when he is trying to adapt? I guess I was kind of confused there.
Yeah, it's complicated because with draft picks specifically, you don't really know, especially in Seattle, you don't really know who made the pick. You know, like it sounds like, Mike, what are you talking about? Pete Carroll makes the picks, right? Now, it's not always that simple. You get in that room, there's a lot of voices in there. There's John Schneider and all his guys. Like, Pete is who ultimately sends in the card because he's the executive VP of football ops, I think is his other title. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there's a coach in there, like, banging the table for a guy. Or sometimes it's a scout, like, banging the table for a guy. Or maybe John Schneider is banging the table for a guy. And Pete's like, you know what? I got to take my guy. Or I got to listen to John here. Or I got to listen to my QB coach here. I got to listen to my D-line coach here. I got to listen to my West Coast scout here. So you really never, you know, it's hard to tell, I guess, is what I'm saying, how all in Pete is on any particular pick. Like by the time we talk to him on Zoom or whatever, he's all in, right? The guy's sure, a Hall of Famer as his name was called. But like in that draft room, there's times, I know this specifically about some picks where Pete has had to be convinced or Pete has had to convince the guys or it was really a debate and, you know, towards the end. Like I think I don't think Pete was like the guy most gung-ho about, like Russ, for example. I think that was John. I think John really liked the guy from Wisconsin, mm-hmm. loved him at the Senior Bowl. Not to say Pete didn't want him. They took him, obviously. But I think he's a good example of like, it did that like really represent a shift in how Pete views a prototypical quarterback because they took Russ? Probably not. Was that him more maybe listening to his guy and trusting a John Schneider in the room? Probably. So with Dwayne, it's hard to know. Now we'll find out later. Maybe that'll be like a story I do. Who stood on the table for Dwayne in that draft room? And was it them? Was it Pete? If it was Shane Waldron, for example, does that show that Pete's adapting or does that show he's willing to trust Shane? Are those one and the same? Those are all good questions. I think my gist is that I don't know if I can give Pete the benefit of the doubt on adapting, especially what we saw last year where he's ground and pound for 6-7 years without winning a title. He goes, Russ, let Russ cook for like 8 weeks and it's like, I'm going to abandon this. Like he couldn't even give adapting a full year. So I think more than anything, 2020 showed us how like unwilling he is to commit to adapting at the first sign of adversity.
But having him trust people is good.
That's
huge. And it's also something that he's been criticized for not doing. I mean, you and Softy were talking about it, that he doesn't have a boss, that he doesn't have any. I mean, he's the grand poobah, and I guess most of the great coaches are kind of the grand poobahs, right? I mean, it's Shula, it's Dicka, it's Parcells, it's Lombardi. I mean, they're the dudes. Like, who are they looking up to? I mean, they're pretty much the guy, right? And Pete, hey, Pete's got a resume like those guys, like some of those guys I just mentioned, especially Parcells and Ditka.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone can. Well, I joke a little bit about him saying that, like, the people who listen to him in the building are his sons. Like, that's just not. I don't think that's, like, the greatest way to run an organization. But I can't fault Pete for wanting to be, like you said, the grand poobah. If I was running an organization like that, I'm not voluntarily having anyone tell me what to do. Like, I'm telling everyone else what to do. I may have, like, a partner who, like, we're equal. Like, we can, but I'm not going to be like, hey, you know what? I need a boss. No. we're going from me down. That's how it works. Well, if it works out, great. And if it doesn't, I'll get fired. But that's how I'm going to structure things. So I don't fault Pete for that. But if we do have criticisms of the organization, that goes to Pete as well. And then it trickles down. And then if we have praise the organization, that starts with Pete, and it trickles down, too. The tricky thing, though, with the roster construction, again, is we don't know who banged the table for what guys or who banged the table for a guy, and then Pete took the other guy or vice versa. There's a lot of stuff. Like, anybody who's been in one of these draft rooms, I'm talking like I've been in one, but anyone who's been in there will tell you there's a lot that goes on. It's not just like GM submits card and done. I mean, maybe that's what's happening with the Raiders, which is why they keep drafting so poorly, but right. Like with everybody else, it's a collaborative effort. And so it's hard to really get a feel for what stuff is Pete's fault and what's not. But I do think overall they have done a bad job as a collective unit
filling out this defense, which is why they've had to pour so many resources into it. And while they're pouring those resources into trades for Quandre and Quentin Dunbars and Jamals and Dunlaps, while they're doing that, they're burning draft picks and having mediocre defenses, which is why last year was so disappointing. They finally had a good defense, and then their offense is what let them down.
Right, right. Great stuff, Michael Sean Dugar, through 1 hour here. We're going to come back. I don't know if you've ever heard Fun with Audio before, but we've got the best quotes from the sports week, and we get to chew on them. And I think, Jackson, you mentioned most of them are NBA playoff related, right? Most of the good stuff. Most of the good stuff we got in the sports media this week was from the NBA playoffs. So Michael Sean and I will chew on that after a top of the hour headlines on 950K.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.